Women and Power, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with two leading commentators on women's history. Anthropologist Laila Abu-Luhad is here to discuss her new book about women in the Middle East. Before that, historian Edna Bay will talk about the role of women in the pre-colonial African kingdom of Dahomey.
At least once a year, there was a major gathering in the capital city, which drew together effectively all the important people in the country. And a lot of Europeans visited at this time and gave us eyewitness accounts of what were essentially councils of state, where women and men would argue and debate issues having to do with the kingdom, with future policies. And women, you know, were witnessed as taking part in these debates.
Historian Edna Bay, she'll be back in just a moment to discuss women and power in the African kingdom of Dahomey. Later on the program, anthropologist Laila Abu-Luhad will be here to discuss writing women's worlds, her new book about Bedouin women. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. As scholars today narrate the story of women and their quest for social equality, they frequently explore the nature of power in both personal and political settings. Likewise, they're interested in how political practices affecting women can be similar or different from one culture to another. Listen now as two leading observers discuss their work about women and power in two distinct locales. Edna Bay of Emory University is here to talk about women and power in the African kingdom of Dahomey. After that, anthropologist Laila Abu-Luhad of New York University will discuss her new book about Bedouin women. Eddie Bay says that in the 19th century, the pre-colonial African kingdom of Dahomey was a slave-trading nation. It occupied an area that's now part of the modern country of Benin, which runs along the western border of Nigeria. Among the early European visitors to Dahomey was Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, the Victorian explorer. When Burton returned to English drawing rooms at mid-century, among other things, he talked about the Palace of Dahomey, a cultural feature that's important to Eddie Bay's study. The palace was a kind of embodiment of Dahomey's monarchy, but it also symbolized what Burton called an ethnological remarkability, namely, the power of women in the governance of the country. I asked Eddie Bay to explain.
Dahomey, in a way, looks a lot like Florida in the sense of, it bordered on the coast, on the West African coast, and then as you go inland, you have essentially relatively flat land, sandy soil, palm trees, tropical kind of growth. The capital of the kingdom was roughly 60 miles in from the coast, so it didn't extend all that far inland. The land got a little bit higher as you went inland, and it was rather hilly as you got further away from the coast. But think of Florida. What Richard Burton was seeing was an organization that people refer to as the Palace of Dahomey. It was essentially the household of the kings, the household of the monarchs. At the time that he visited Dahomey, which was in 1863, 1864, there were somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 women making up this palace. Technically, all of these women were wives of the king.
My goodness. So polygyny?
Polygyny is the correct term. Polygyny meaning, of course, a man with many, many wives. Polygamy is the term that people use popularly, and it's technically incorrect because polygamy can refer to a man with many wives or a woman with many husbands.
Now, when we try to unpack the idea of political power and the status of women in pre-colonial Dahomey, what kind of power are we talking about? The most abstract political kind of thing, or day-to-day relationships among and between men and women and children and the social order?
Women within the palace functioned in all sorts of ways that were politically important. For example, there was an army of women in 19th century Dahomey, which obviously was an arm of policy in many senses. there were women whose positions paralleled the position of all the major ministers of state, so that at any given time, for example, you'd have two prime ministers, one who was male and the other who was female. The king himself was paralleled or doubled, I guess you could say, by a woman who was called the Kpojito. Most people in English would use the term queen mother for this kind of office, but a woman who ruled with the king, who was very much involved in making decisions about the state, making decisions about policy, and who wielded effectively a great deal of power.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have written, Eddie Bay, that in the religion of pre-colonial Dahomey, we have a male-female creative power at work. Is this what accounts for the division of labor politically and the willingness of the men to share the power with the women?
That's a question that I haven't figured out the answer for yet. It's one of the things that is interesting about this male-female doubling that you find everywhere in Dahomey by the 19th century is that it seems to have been begun in the 18th century and seems to have been begun as a kind of a religious model that mimics, in fact, the realities of politics as they existed at that time. In the middle of the 18th century, there was a very, very powerful king who had a very, very powerful queen mother or reign mate, this woman I mentioned just a minute ago. The two of them effectively ruled in tandem and appear to have conceived of their own positions as a kind of a pairing of power.
What would you call this, feminism? Is this some sort of pre-colonial or colonial feminism that is exciting to you historians because it rings the bell in the modern world, so to speak?
No, I don't believe that we can call it feminism in the sense that women's power was not directed toward affecting the position of women as women. There were certainly signs, for example, among the women warriors of Dahomey, there were signs of a kind of sense of solidarity amongst those warriors, but I wouldn't call that feminism. Indeed, the war songs that many people recorded and remember about them have to do with them singing, "We are not women, but men. Send the men to the fields to do the hoeing and the planting and the harvesting. We will fight." They're often referred to as Amazons, which is a term I don't like to use, because essentially their role was much more like our contemporary women soldiers. That is, that these were people who happened to be female who were doing the same thing that male soldiers did. The companies of soldiers were separate, so that there would be women's companies and men's companies. So they were not integrated or mixed in that sense, but women essentially were fighters and in the 19th century became known as the fiercest of the fighters.
But again, this does not spring from an ideology of equality. This is not some large abstract, as it were, feminist force at work. This is simply the way these men and women divided the power and the responsibility.
Yes, I think that would be fair to say. Dahomey is a very pragmatic place. And in the early days, you had a small kingdom that was struggling to grow. You didn't have many people. And in those days, again, remember, we're talking about a situation where slave raiding is going on. If a community was attacked, everybody would get out to fight against an attacker. And what my theory is that Dahomeans adopted this principle, this idea that anybody in a community can go out with a machete, with a club, with some kind of a weapon to fight against an aggressor. Mm-hmm. And they developed it over time into what essentially became a fighting force that included women as well as men. The other way in which women, I think, were very, very central was in the physical sense of the palace itself. Because remember, the king is living in the palace with all of these women. they controlled access to the king. And in fact, in public audiences, there was, you could see this in a literal sense, that a stranger would come in to meet the king in a huge courtyard in the interior of the palace. And across the middle of that courtyard, there was a line on the ground that was made by a row of the midribs of palm branches. No man could cross that line. Inside that line was the palace as an organization and the king himself. So if, for example, you were going to visit the king with a request, you would come into the palace, you would come up to that line, you would have to stop there. A woman from the palace organization would come down to that line, you would tell her what you wanted to say to the king, and then she would go back and tell the king.
Eddie Bay, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let me present you with another big order. What are you trying to do with the history of Dahomey? How are you trying to rethink it and represent it to your colleagues and to your students, for example? How do you talk to yourself about this enterprise?
I'm essentially trying to do two things. One is to make people understand a different conception of power. The idea that both women and men were involved at the top of the state, along with the king, in making decisions and in carrying them out. Secondly, I'm interested in showing that there was change over time in this state and who was at that top and wielding that power, because what I've found is that that cast of characters, those coalitions that were essentially making decisions about the kingdom, changed a great deal over time, changed in terms of the social origins of those people, changed in terms of how many were female as opposed to male, changed in terms of their families of origin. And those are the kinds of factors that I'm trying to tease out of the evidence.
Edna Bay teaches at Emory University. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study of women and power in the pre-colonial African kingdom of Dahomey. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Coming up in just a moment, another conversation about women and power. Anthropologist Laila Abu-Luhad of New York University will present an overview of her new book about Bedouin women.
By telling their stories, I want to show several kinds of things. I want to show the ways in which they strategize within the system that they live in, mm-hmm. the kinds of ways that they have of resisting mm-hmm. Power. I want to show the kinds of stories that they tell, the kinds of fun that they have. I want to show the kinds of links among women, the kinds of bonds of friendship and intimacy that can develop when people live so closely together. I think it's something that we've lost in America.
Anthropologist Laila Abu-Luhad of New York University. Her new book is Writing Women's Worlds, an account of modern-day Bedouin women. Among other things, the book treats patriarchy, polygamy, and marriage and reproduction. It also considers large themes such as honor and shame, but it does so in terms of the everyday lives of women in a small Bedouin community located in Egypt. By living in this community over a 10-year period, Laila Abu-Luhad took part in Bedouin family life. Firsthand, she saw moments of humor, affection, and anger. She also witnessed the sorts of changes, both cultural and economic, that are affecting the present-day lives of women in one of the world's oldest cultures. Here's Laila Abu-Luhad.
I write about three women, but many others related to them, and all of them live in a community in the western desert of Egypt, west of Alexandria, all along the coast. This group was quite close to Alexandria. Mm-hmm. And they're a group of Bedouins. By that we mean the pastoralists of the Arab world, but the group that I lived with, like most pastoralists these days, are actually settled, living in houses rather than tents, and they might keep some herds, but they make a living by doing lots of other things, including business ventures.
All right, now my impression is that this would be a pretty tough life, I'm about to use a loaded term here, Lila, primitive by Western standards. Am I right about that? What were the social conditions like?
Right. Well, I think you have to think about it. Is it the social conditions for them or for me?
Uh-huh.
It was obviously a harder life than I'm used to,
right.
Although I did have the luxury of living in a house and I had my own bed,
uh-huh,
and a room that I often shared with the teenage girls in the family. I found it hard from time to time. There were fleas. But there was running water, mm-hmm, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have electricity in the first years that I lived with them. So I think by our standards, we would say that was a hard life.
Now, what was the object of your visit in this Bedouin community? You went there to write about women. From what particular perspective or argument, angle, what did you bring to the experience?
Well, I have a long history with them. The first time I went, 78 to 80, I was interested in the relations between men and women and curious about women's lives in this kind of community. And I had a suspicion that for the Arab world, Bedouin women would be among the most free in their choices, and relations between men and women would be the most flexible of the kinds of communities. So I went to find out about that. Instead, I ended up learning about poetry and the kinds of poetry that women recite to express feelings that they couldn't express otherwise.
Uh-huh.
But that's not so much what I talk about in this book.
Well, what is the object of this book then?
In this book, I went back to the same community because I felt, after writing my first book, Veiled Sentiments, that I hadn't been able to capture the quality of life as it's lived, the texture of everyday life in this community, and to really convey the complicated kinds of arguments and differences among women that I found in the community.
So what you're doing here is offsetting some of these stereotypes about what kind of monolithic life and monolithic methods of thinking among and between women in this community. We're on the right track?
That's exactly right, Wayne. And it was stereotypes, of course, that we hold in the West, not stereotypes they hold about themselves. And I think I was trying to convey by taking, say, three different women of different generations, how things had changed, but also how you could have very different kinds of personalities,
uh-huh,
even within the same social community.
All right. Now, one of the women that you write about is a relatively young person. You'll tease out the details here for me, Lila. The first one in her family to complete secondary school. What is it that makes this woman's life in this Bedouin community worthy of a book for an American audience?
Right. Well, she's only one of the several women I talk about, and I think she's interesting because she embodies some of the contradictions. As women are moving out of one sort of social world in which they had certain kinds of powers, certain kinds of freedoms, and certain ways of expressing that, moving into a different world through her education, through participating in schools and in the larger world of Egypt.
All right, now, would we call this feminism? Is that a word that you would apply to this community and with a straight face and have these women themselves understand it?
Right. They don't have a word for feminism, and I don't actually use that word because I think you have to be careful. You have to, you know, people are feminists if they say they're feminists and if they have a project of emancipation for women. I don't think that's the case in this Bedouin community.
Yet their lives are changing. You just said that they're in what ways?
Although, in fact, I think they're losing. I would say that the grandmother that I describe in this book, the girl who went to high school's grandmother, actually has much more, has resisted much more of what's been imposed upon her and has a lot more independence from men and from for example, I tell stories in this book about her early life, stories that she tells about the way she resisted certain marriages that her father tried to arrange for her. Now,
uh-huh,
we assume an arranged marriage means women have no rights in this society. This is not feminism. This is a society ripe for feminism. But in fact, she resisted three times marriages that he'd already agreed with other people for. And she found various ways of doing this by pretending to be crazy once, by just refusing at other times.
And not eating.
And not eating, right. She fasted for 12 days. She said she'd been possessed by spirits. And so they let her off. Uh-huh. Now, she couldn't confront it directly and say, I don't want this marriage. But she found a way to get out of it. And there are lots of other, she lives much more in a women's world and assumes that she would be quite separate from men, except her sons, and that gives her a certain amount of independence. What happens in the younger generation now, with Kamala, this granddaughter of hers, she has certain aspirations that we might associate with feminism or with a kind of westernization. She wants to have she wants to marry somebody educated. She wants to live in a nuclear family. She wants to only have two children, as she's been told by the population control people and all the propaganda she gets in school. And that's a kind that will improve her status in some ways. But it also puts her under the thumb of her husband much more than her grandmother ever was.
Lila, you write about three women in your book, Writing Women's Worlds. One of them is a relatively young person whose name is Gatifa. She's a member of a polygynous household, which means that she's one woman with one husband, but he has several other wives. Tell me about her. What is life like for her?
Okay, in a way, I would turn the question around and say, Gatifa lives in a household with several co-wives, and they have a husband, with the focus being on the world of the women, because that's the world that she lives in. She
does that mean that she never talks to other men?
No, of course not. She talks to her husband. She talks to her sons. Mm-hmm. She talks to most of the young men in the community. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel as relaxed with the older men in the community of the sort of wealthier family that she belongs to, the sort of respected senior men of the family group, mm-hmm. Because there are certain restrictions on, there's a certain discomfort in cross-sex.
Now, let me stop you for a moment. Right. Lila, suppose we were to take this person, Gatifa, who I take it this is a fictional name that you're applying mm-hmm. to one of these Bedouin women that you write about.
It means velvet.
Velvet, wonderful. and you transported this person in space and time to an American household. Mm. Would there be a comfort element there? Would this person be living in an utterly different world, given the world that she comes from? How universal, in fact, is our common humanity?
I think that has two sides to it. Of course, in the superficial elements of the structure of our houses and the kind of furniture that we have.
Supermarkets, and things like that.
And supermarkets. She's barely dreamt of things like that. But in terms of the common humanity, obviously I lived in her household for many years and didn't find any problems in her relating to me or me to her. We have different expectations of life, of marriage, but certain similar concerns in terms of love of family, mm-hmm. Caring about the people you know, wanting to be respected.
Mm-hmm. Lila, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. One final question about stereotypes and the women of the Middle East. What about these awful stories that we in the West hear frequently, not only with respect to domestic issues and political issues, but sexual and personal issues? What should we make of stories like that?
I think there's a long history of the construction of the exotic and the other that dates back to colonialism, in which women were very key emblems of the backwardness of the societies that the West was trying to colonize. Mm-hmm. The Middle East is no exception. And I think those things continue to today. How can you justify power over or superiority over another society except by denouncing their practices, showing what's so horrible about them? And one of the things people often say is, look how badly they treat their women. And I think that many of the stories we hear are part of that construction of the other as justifiably to be controlled. Mm-hmm. There are sexual practices practices related to marriage that we probably would find disturbing, one of the things I talk about in my book, or one of the kinds of stories I tell, are about weddings and a practice that many of us would find puzzling, an insistence on virginity at marriage, which is not so puzzling, but also a public proof of virginity at marriage. And that's been very troubling for Westerners looking at Middle Eastern societies, and the Bedouins have a kind of classic case of this. And so what I try to do is show what happens at a wedding in the chamber, to show the conflicts among the women, to show what they really care about, to show that it's not kind of, it's a ritual, but it's not gone through in an emotionless way. It's actually a very tense moment, and a lot is at stake in a family at this moment. And I try to show that by showing real people going through that experience. I also make fun of us a little bit by showing what, by having conversations with the Bedouin women about what goes on in the West, mm-hmm. to show you how strange they think what goes on here is. And they're shocked to find out that a husband and wife want to go off all by themselves on the wedding night and actually go away for a honeymoon. They're shocked that nobody cares to see the that the bride was a virgin. There are many things that came out in my conversations with them that I try to convey by telling the stories of these conversations, many of which I taped while I was there.
Laila Abu-Luhad is a professor of anthropology at New York University. Her new book is Writing Women's Worlds, an account of Bedouin women, available from the University of California Press. Stay tuned for information about writing for a cassette tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Edna Bay of Emory University and Laila Abu-Luhad of New York University. For an audio cassette of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 723. That's program number 723. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week, a conversation about language, literature, and African culture in the Caribbean. My guest will be Maureen Warner Lewis of the University of the West Indies. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.